I'm here with Tim Ruse. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi. Now, you are the CEO for Zero Latency, the location-based VR that started in Melbourne. And you are in Melbourne yourself?
I am, absolutely. Sunny Melbourne.
Yes. Could you give us a quick rundown of what Zero Latency is for people that may not be aware?
So Zero Latency is a free-roam virtual reality experience. And what that means is, unlike traditional VR, where you're either in a small space with wires or a small space with a wireless headset, we have taken all those wires away and also made it really social and multiplayer. So you come to a Zero Latency venue, we put you in a backpack and a headset, give you a controller, and then you essentially interact with these digital worlds that we've created just like they're real life.
Yeah. And I think I actually was down at your Melbourne location the year it launched. I think it was the day before PAX Australia.
And
I remember there was a taco van, but I think I missed out. I think they just served the last taco as I arrived, and I was...
I missed out those tacos as well. we underordered tacos and overordered beer for that party. Never again.
There was a lot of beer for that. And you were testing what I guess turned up being the game Engineerium there, where it was you were doing all the walking on the wall stuff. And I thought it was a great mix of... drunken industry people playing a game where literally you walk on the ceiling. I didn't see nobody lost any lunch or anything. Nobody lost a taco, so I think it worked pretty well.
That was a win. That's been one of the really interesting things as we've been building the system out for close to 6 years, or it's almost 7 years actually, through the sort of proof of concept stages, seeing when you map that movement one-to-one and you're moving people physically through a space. It does a few interesting things, and one of them is really remove any chance of nausea, even if you're doing pretty crazy stuff, like, as you said, walking up walls or, you know, sort of some M.C. Escher kind of worlds that we create. It really gives you a lot more latitude in what you can do in virtual reality. Mm. It takes away a lot of the constraints that in-home experiences have.
So you were kind enough to let the Zed Games crew come to the Brisbane location. We went 2 weeks ago now, I think, at this point. And we played through Singularity. And some of those levels are just... It's mostly a shooting game, but some of them are just like a fun house. Where it's like, walk down this slope.
Because you're
not physically walking down a slope.
That game was an interesting challenge where we created it and... one of the developers at the time set himself a challenge of basically doing it end-to-end without having any, like, level loads or teleports. So it's a pretty interesting experiment. I think probably the only game that we've built, I think anyone in the world's built, where you never have a real level load. Sometimes other games where we have to transport you to a different area, we sort of fade in, fade out, and you're in a different zone. But that one, for the full 30 minutes, you're reusing the space, using tricky things like ramps, elevators, moving platforms to send you through like hundreds and hundreds of meters of, virtual world when you're just traveling, you know, through a 200 square meter space.
Yeah, because the warehouse is big, but not that big.
Yeah, it's not a football field, sadly. One day.
One day we'll get there. That's one of the interesting things I thought about Zero Latency is that, because you were... I mean, I'm not sure the history of people trying location-based VR, but you're the sort of the first commercial success that I can remember. But you guys are also, you're developing the hardware and the software on site, because upstairs you had that little development studio that sat above the floor. And so you could actually sit down and watch people playing and testing the game sort of real time.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, back in 2015 or 2016, we were all housed in one building, which had its moments of, it's got pretty squishy, but it was really very cool to be able to, you know, if you stayed at work past 5 o'clock, you could actually watch people play, and that connectivity to the customers was really cool. We actually do that now where we bring in groups of people under our Alpha Army program, we call it, where they come in a couple of times a week and play the games in our new office, so you can actually, you know, get people through and play and see what works. It's really, 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 really critical. But we've moved on as well from our hardware being, we're trying to get, what we've been doing all along really is getting best of breed hardware that's available and putting Zero Latency sort of special sauce in it, and then linking it all together to make it a really seamless experience for operators and for users as well, or for guests. So before like when we started building it, I think we had a DK2, we had a few DK2s, that was a bit of a grey area about whether we could use them. And, you know, and we're building our own backpacks from scratch with stuff from the computer store, putting backpacks that were getting hand-stitched by a cosplay person in Melbourne, which is pretty cool. But pioneering has its downsides, because it's very hard to scale that up as a business. So we've luckily been able to, as we go, switch out different products like new headsets, new backpacks, to, I guess, streamline what we do and focus on what we really want to be doing, which is delivering amazing VR experiences to guests, either via our own sites that we operate all over the world, or our third party operators that we sell to as well.
Yeah, when we went through, the hardware we used was pretty similar to what I recall back in the day. Sort of the stuff that the tracking ball, similar to like the PS Move.
Yeah.
I don't know. Are they actually like pieces of PS Move hardware, or are they just similar concept?
They used to be butchered PS Move controllers, but actually all that stuff's made bespoke for us from different manufacturers around the place. But Brisbane's actually going to get a refresh probably in the next 6 months onto our new Gen 2 gear. But it's a really robust platform, Gen 1, which is what you would have played up there. It still delivers a pretty awesome experience, and you can still play all our games on it. It's pretty cool, Brisbane, as well. It's a nice big space up there as well.
Yeah, it was. Because that's VR is such a quick reiteration of hardware generations at the moment. I was a Quest 1 adopter, and then it was, a year and a half, and the Quest 2's coming out?
Thankfully,
I still like the Quest 1. It's still the best. But that stuff reiterates so quickly, and people that are into VR, really, like, they're really hardware focused on the whole.
Yeah, so I think it's certainly it's interesting to sort of see that split as well. A lot of the people that come, excuse me, and play zero latency games, especially now in, 2021, but certainly 2019, 2020, even 2018, I think it started to shift in. It's not just gamers and VR enthusiasts. It's entering into that. If you want to do something fun, you got some money in your pocket, you want to do something fun with your friends, it's moving more, not into the full mainstream, but into more early adopters that are interested in finding new stuff to do.
Yeah.
It's been an interesting switch. So I think the hardware is important, but the most important thing is that it all runs smoothly. And something that we're always battling with is when new things are released, they can be better, but there's also, as time goes on, problems are found with them. So it's that fine line of wanting to get the best hardware into the market, but also being cognizant that you need to release it in stages and pressure test it to make sure that it's fit for purpose.
Because that was whilst I was saying the stuff we were using was the sort of similar to the older generation I'd used, it was also so robustly worked out at that point. You had this clips on that side, this clips on that side. Everyone knows where everything is. You know, it has that sort of testing that if you're constantly chasing that rabbit of the newest tech, well, you're always going to be on an edge there, aren't you? Where it may not be.
Yeah. You want to be on the bleeding edge, not the hemorrhaging to death edge. And it's the fine line. Yeah.
We want to be feet solid on the ground, thanks.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, especially with the way that we structured our business, where we are selling it to third parties, and, you know, most of them are technical enthusiasts, but they're not developers, they're not VR, hardware developers. So we really try very hard and iterate through to make sure things are, you know, as robust as possible, but also as easy to use as possible. And some of the stuff that you mentioned, that, you know, the clips, as an example, it seems like a simple thing, but they've changed two or three times, different colors, different placements. And you only really see that when you put hardware through the hands of thousands of people and observed it. You know, you sort of start to see trends and like, oh, that made sense. And, you know, always remind myself and the team, it's like, we're not making it for us. You know, ultimately we're making it for customers. So we've got to remove that preconceived knowledge that we have of the hardware and think, all right, you've never used a VR backpack before. Maybe you've come with your friends. Maybe you've had a few beers. I've got to put it in your hands and you've got to make it work. Like, what does that look like? It's a very different experience to, you know, being a hardware enthusiast and using the gear. So that that ease of use is critical. And the other thing I think that's really surprises people, we're delivering things like experiences on a game engine, and they are games, but they're a very different experience design than if you're at home. Because if I'm building a game for your console, I've got you for hours, and I can, you know, integrate things in slowly. I can take you on a tutorial. Mm. I can, there's different ways I can teach you, but if I've got you for half an hour and I've only got 5 minutes to sort of get you into the game and get you comfortable, what I can do and how I do that is very different to traditional game design. And when we hire, excuse me, game developers, sometimes we've got to unlearn a bunch of stuff. It's like, oh, we don't have the luxury of, if it's too complicated, it doesn't work.
If we give you something simple that might take someone 5-10 minutes to sort out, they may not be able to finish their session in time.
Yeah, exactly. Or they have a really average time. And, you know, it's really important to have done tests over the years that people want to be challenged, but they don't want to be decimated. And we're trying to appeal to, you're making a game that someone can come in who's not a VR, not a gamer or not particularly confident. And they've got to have a good time as well as someone that's played a couple of times. So trying to pitch something that appeals to everybody is really, really important. And focusing very much on, you're having an adventure. That's ultimately what we're trying to build. It's like you come with your buddies, you put on your headset, we transport you to a different world, you have this awesome adventure, shoot some stuff, have fun for 30 minutes, and then you're back in the room. That sense of fun and pace and adventure is really critical. It's like, we're not there to, you know, it's not Dark Souls in VR. We're trying to let people, if you're a masochist, it might not be for you.
But hey, there could be a market in the masochistic VR.
Absolutely. There's no more niches anymore. Everything's mainstream.
Exactly.
On a global scale.
On your development, so is everything that you guys play developed entirely in-house because of your technology?
Say that again.
Oh, so is everything that you guys are all the games that are in your catalog, are they all developed in house?
Actually, no. Well, the ones that are available to the majority of the public are all developed in house. We've got a new game that we're rolling out slowly called Mission Maybe, which is an awesome game for more for sort of families. It's a
shooter, scary girl, isn't it?
Yeah, Scary Girl Mission Maybe. That's actually an Australian guy that created that IP. So that's a new game that was developed by a third party, which they'd actually built it for a system like ours, and they ported it across. And that had its own challenges and its own opportunities, and that was a good project. We learned a lot. I think everyone learned a lot in that project to sort of make something that works well for our system and for our clientele. But our latest game, which is probably in this final stage of development, is working with Ubisoft on the Far Cry IP to bring the Far Cry 3 world into VR and free roam VR, which is awesome. And that's such a great experience. It's pretty ambitious. It's a full half hour. Like, some of that game's only 15 minutes long, and you play two of them. It's a full half hour, seamless experience.
And are you working with really any cool Ubisoft teams with that? Or is it...
We're working with have engaged with them. We've worked with them for almost 3 years to sort of find the right time, and the hardware had to be at a level where it could provide an experience that they'd be happy putting the IP on. And our Gen 2 hardware fitted that bill. And then we've just been working with them. They're doing all the dev on it, but where we come in. Yeah, so it's just really cool. It's interesting to work with a big studio and, you know, learn how they do things and the strengths and weaknesses of their models and everything. But building it from scratch in that IP, so going, okay, here's some constraints. Like, we want it to feel like Far Cry, but we also need to take advantage of what's awesome in a system. We need to make it super fun and cooperative for up to eight players. And it's awesome. It's a really fun adventure. I said it's the most ambitious thing we've done. You really feel like you've gone on this pretty intense journey because you travel through kind of almost eight or more, depending on how you sort of frame them, eight separate kind of areas. So you really, like, you start up high, you go down low, you get giving too much away, but you have this really pretty intense time and you travel a lot of ground, which is something that it's more expensive to do in development because you've got to keep generating assets, but there's something really fun and you sort of lose your sense of time and place when you're traveling through this giant world. It's definitely worth the investment. It's a very, very fun game.
I mean, you definitely stick us in a helicopter at some point and we shoot things as we go into an encampment, right? I mean, it's Far Cry.
We've used our helicopters before. This one may or may not have a helicopter. but it's a very cool experience and fun to, you know, to meet some of the iconic villains from that franchise in VR is pretty cool as well. Some really interesting new ground that we're traveling there, and one of our sort of goals when we do content is to try something, like we don't want to reinvent the wheel every time because that's just madness, but to bring something new to each game that we build. So we'll bring a bunch of learnings from all our other games and we know what works, but then we'll go, okay, let's try something different with this game.
Speaking about going the other way, have you investigated at all porting any of your games to home headsets?
Yeah, that's something that's actually an active discussion at the moment. The answer is we haven't done one yet. We've got a couple of candidates that we think could be really good for that medium, but there's a couple of things we need to iron out to make it, I guess, expedient to bring that across to the platform. I think the answer is we haven't, but there's definitely conversations happening around how we can do that in a way that allow, like, could, is there a way you could put that at the end of the pipeline of development? So you don't have to like go, oh, great, it works in free roam location based. All right, now we're going to do another 6 months of work to make it work at home, and then looking at how that would look.
One of my friends works Space Pirate Trainer, and they were working on a game Arena, where it was local multiplayer, and you just get a big space, and four people can chuck on headsets, it drops in a level, and you run around. It's a shooter, and I think I think COVID had a big impact on their business strategy there. So I think that's somewhat not on the burner at the moment. But even then, you have to break a bunch of quest policies to even make it work. So I don't think home hardware can quite deliver a experience that you guys can yet. Plus, even then, you need so much hardware.
Yeah, you do need hardware, and then you need to... I think it's really interesting opportunities to bring things onto those cheaper headsets and make it easy enough for people to join together and play. Then the questions are, like, is it something that you play in a, you know, basketball court with four of you? Is that something that's practical? Can the tracking handle it? It's been very interesting / I think very disappointing for a lot of developers. I was reading an article about it, about Facebook's kind of chokehold grip on the Quest platform. And suggesting also to see an antitrust motion being spun up in America against Facebook, because it's like, that those policies and their restrictions of what you can do with the Quest 2, it's not going to help innovation. Like, I think they've got a strategy of, obviously they've got a wider strategy, and Facebook's not wanting for money, but I look at the Oculus versus the Vive, and ultimately the Vive won hands down in terms of, leave Sony aside, which is a different proposition because they already had a very big install base, which was clever to then put a headset on top of. But, you know, working with Oculus was challenging for developers, and Vive was like, hey, like, just like, here's dev kits, like, just, you know, go nuts, do whatever you want. Do you want to set up a VR arcade? Set up a video arcade, like, set up two of them, like, go do what you want. And I think there's an interesting conundrum there of, you want to protect your platform and your brand and execute your vision as a business, but if it's too narrow, you're not going to get developers wanting to work with you. And there was a few notable cases of Facebook basically busting people's software and then releasing their own versions of it, which is not a great vibe if you're trying to bring people onto a nascent platform.
We're not going to release you, but we have our own version of it. And that's the, I have a few friends that do, and the development side's easy enough, but it's the release. You can release stuff on SideQuest, but I mean, that has a user base of, I don't know, I'm going to guess less than 1% of the full audience. Only for enthusiasts, really.
Yeah, and I think that's, I think we're at a pivotal time in a lot of different ways in the world at the moment, but certainly with, XR technology generally of... There's been a lot of talk. There's been some great products. There's been products that are too expensive. There's been products like Magic Leap that just turned out to be, I don't know, be diplomatic. It appeared to be almost complete vaporware, and that's being diplomatic about what happened there. You just hope something like the Quest is such a powerful platform. It's easy. It's easy to set up. It's cheap. But if they're being too restrictive with what people can do on it, like, it still doesn't have the reach of a PlayStation. I think there's 100 million PlayStations in the world. There'd be under a million Quests.
The technology is great. If the business could catch up and be a little bit more open, that would be great.
Yeah, and how are you going to get it? I mean, you look at the early days of mobile app development, and, you know, it was pretty niche there for a few years, and then the handsets went everywhere and exploded. And, you know, you need a big install base to attract developers, and even then you still need to encourage devs to, if you want independent developers to work on your platform, like, you don't want to spend $1 million developing something and then turn around and Facebook's like, oh, sorry, you can't deploy that. That's not going to, I don't know. It's look, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's done a fantastic job building Facebook, and it's certainly more successful than zero latency at this stage. But I'd just be interested to see how they execute on that walled garden approach, because it's certainly not winning. It doesn't seem to be wildly popular with the development community.
No, anyway. if you can't get guarantees, then why are you going to sink in the time and the money to do it?
Yeah, and your bigger, you know, when you talk to or look at your bigger game development companies, they're looking for billion-dollar opportunities, and that's why they keep cycling through old content. You want to do a new IP at, you know, EA Games, like, you need to show how you can get a billion-dollar.
Yeah, EA, you know, doesn't care if it's good. It's like, oh, no, yeah, you turn 20%, who cares? Nothing.
Well, you know, and there's, you know, it's game development's really expensive, and it's risky. It's a hit-based business. So if you want to bring big developers onto a platform, you need a lot of headsets sold before they'll even get on it. You look at mobile development, like your EA Games and your larger developers didn't get on that platform for a long time until it was proven by smaller independent developers taking risks and, you know, early adopters proving out what could work. And then the big dogs come in and, you know, either join forces with the ones that want to play or devour the ones that don't want to play and wade into that market. So I don't see how that's going to be different with VR. And there's already been a huge amount of money sunk in, like, publicly, and I would imagine under the table, in terms of getting software onto the platform. Like, there's been a huge amount of money. I think, you know, there was a multi-million, a multi-hundred million, maybe not 100 million, but Vive, I remember, had a huge developer fund. There's been a lot of money sunk into content already to try to kickstart that ecosystem. It's very interesting ground. Such a complicated business model. You know, that intersection of hardware sales, developers, consumers getting what they want. You're not going to buy a headset unless there's games, but developers aren't going to build games unless there's enough headsets.
It's always the catch-22, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting.
I think VR also has that need to prove itself, which is partly why places like You Can Be Good, because you can take the company there or your friends there and, hey, give it a shot. Because I don't know if... So, if you're like a games website and you drop VR content, nobody clicks on it. Because people that don't have VR, that aren't already invested, hate listening to it. Because they don't... It's not that they don't understand, but they just haven't invested it. They don't feel. And generally, once you get someone a bit of experience, they suddenly are a lot more interested in where it can go. Because at the moment, I think it's most of the current hardware is at a point of maturity that it really sells people. I can give it to my grandma. Yeah. I can give it to my gamer friends. And everyone understands because everyone knows how to look at stuff and use their hands.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other really, like, you look at the trajectory of a lot of technology, especially entertainment. If you look at the big, you know, the big sort of categories, like the moving image as an example, which is essentially movies, and then it went to television, et cetera, it all started out of home because people, when something's new, they don't necessarily understand it. And especially, I think VR is very different. And you see that from some of the early games people put together that made people sick or weren't good fun because they tried to get old tropes and bring them into VR. And then, you know, some very, you know, creative person came up with Beat Saber, which is a fantastic native VR game. It's like, well, what would I do with this medium now? Not thinking, you know, drawing influence from, you know, what I'm trying to say, those rhythm games, et cetera. But they were like, oh, no, what works in VR? You know, and I thought that was really clever. And I think you need more of that sort of stuff to happen to really build out that ecosystem. And, I mean, how long were video games? I was just watching a doco over the holidays on Netflix about it. How long, you know, video games kind of took to come of age and be mainstream. It was really the Nintendo that brought it into everyone's homes. It took like 10 years.
and early
arcade, or even longer.
And because now there's like your cheap VRs, your phone-based VRs and stuff like that, you get the problem of early VR, which is, I used to be a great litmus test for friends that were developers and everything, because my headset to vomit was about 30 seconds to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And that was pre-Vive, because as soon as the head tracking came in properly, the first time I was in a Vive, I spent an hour in it. It's like, it works now. But if you don't have that proper tracking, a lot of people still think it's terrible.
Yeah. Well, there's something very, like, it's a lot less, which is, I mean, I think a lot of people have learned that, and there's a lot of, you know, standards out there and stuff that we've pioneered and other people have done to sort of push it all forwards. But Yeah, it doesn't. It's very different to a screen. You can look away from a screen. It's a very different experience, which is why we find when, like, we don't let children play, because if you're under 10, there's something very intense about not being able to escape the simulation. It's very different being on a phone or even watching a scary movie and being able to hide under your doona or whatever. It's very different when it's, like, stuck to your head. You can't get away. Like, it's just such a different... so I'm so fascinated to work in it. It's... Yes, it's a bit like a phone strapped to your face, but the implications on the human body and the mind using it is so different to a mobile phone. And I think that's why the, you know, we're starting to see those changes happening where people are designing for the device. They're not trying to port old ideas across to it. And, you know, you're getting some killer apps starting to manifest, which is really cool.
VR immersion is always like a slight danger, because even like I use VR a relatively high amount, and I was very excited to come and play and see what your current games were and everything. And even then, when I was walking through an archway, I put my hand up to balance myself on it.
I think
that it just takes some people to a moment to forget, and they're leaning on a table or resting on a box or something, and they're on the floor, because it just sells immersion.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also something about walking. I find the more that people walk, so they're walking and what they're seeing is mapping very closely to what they're feeling. And that really levels up that immersion, which is why when we put someone on a plank, so we have a bridge, we have bridge moments, we call them in most of our games, where you're up high and you have to go across something or walk, you know, side of a building or whatever. And there's always a small percentage of people that have bona fide, like, fear of heights that just won't do it. And it's interesting to sort of see them look at their, like, come out of it and be like, I guess decompressing about it and being like, oh, that was so strange, because I knew, like, in my mind that it wasn't real, but I couldn't step out on that ledge because I just, my fear kicked in. And that's I think it's part of, like, when you see people having those visceral experiences, you don't get that playing Clash Royale, you don't get that playing other games. There's something really powerful about the medium. Well, and I think
walking across the small bridge, whilst I'm like, I wasn't scared. I'm like, oh, no, I'm on concrete. I'm like, I still balanced on it.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Why was I balancing?
There's also some interesting sort of reptile brain stuff. Like if you, you know, there's, yeah, it's like the whole thing with babies. There's a certain point quite early in their development where they won't walk across the glass table. But, you know, they do this thing where they put them over a glass that they can look down and see a dangerous gap. And there's a certain point really early in human development where they won't walk across it. Or won't crawl across it. It's very interesting, all that stuff that's locked up in your head that you just take for granted. And I think that's part of what we try to do in a way that doesn't, like, mess with people too much. There's things that we do that kind of help disorientate you in a good way. And the more that you're abstracted away from, you know, the time and space that you're in, you get to take people to some really, really interesting territory that they don't really realize they're going to go into. And they come out, I think, profoundly moved by the experience. Like, and not, yes, it's not, you know, it's not a, they are shooters and they're there to have fun, but that's what really drives, you know, drives me, and I think drives a lot of the team, is there's, you see the a profound effect it has on people, and you're like, there's something very, very interesting happening in that XR space that is still, we're only really scratching the surface of, which is exciting, you know, and I think there's going to be onwards and upwards for here for that technology as things get cheaper, you know, battery technology gets better. There's a whole bunch of stuff coming together that is going to make the next continued sort of 5 years of development really exciting.
So I had one very specific hardware request inquiry from when I was playing, which was the guns, which feel not pretty well mapped inside. It's not, it's great holding a real object, but, you know, I'm a child of the arcade. I love Time Crisis. I really love some sort of some force feedback, some sort of haptic feedback on stuff like that. Is that anything that might be coming in future?
Well, haptics is not is very challenging. We've tried a bunch of different ideas. We've tried, like, vests. We had solenoids hooked up. We've tried off-the-shelf gear.
I've used one of those before. Very mixed results, aren't they?
Yeah, the Wuja vest is pretty good, but it's an interesting combination of, it adds complexity to the system, and it's another thing to charge, another thing that can go wrong. And when it's not done well, it's bad. I feel we get an okay result having a heavier prop and the audio, but I really hope that someone solves the haptics problem. We've tried to solve it, but it's a bridge too far for us to make something that is, because you're constantly balancing quality of experience, but also what people are willing to pay per ticket, what people are willing to pay the bar system. And that's the kicker.
Yeah, how much maintenance and everything and extra equipment, everything can you afford to have?
Yeah. And to be honest, you know, the less maintenance that we hear from our customers and our operators is we want less maintenance. Like we want it to be simpler. And I think it's always about finding that sweet spot. Absolutely.
I think there's a wide amount of excitement once friends and I got hands on the PS5 controller, because we suddenly just wanted to force that into everything. It's like, can we make this work with this system instead?
Yeah. Makes a difference.
It does. It does. Generally, then, I'm just seeing what else I had on my little list here. I think we've hit a lot of stuff. Just generally, you're opening a new studio in Sydney? A new location in Sydney?
Yeah. We've got one open in Brisbane right now. It just opened up in Sydney just before Christmas. So, yeah, if you're in pretty much if you're in Brisbane, the Gold Coast, Sydney, Melbourne, or Perth, head on down to Azira Latency.
Yeah. And at the moment, what sort of timeline this year would we expect to try that Far Cry game that's coming out?
It's in the first half of this year. It's going to be shipped.
Oh, well,
find the right time.
Yeah. Thank you for your time, Tim. It's been great having a little chat with you. Great.
Likewise. I enjoyed it. That was great. Looking, all the best.